and welcome to this episode of Stats, the podcast where we share the accomplishments of the Department of Surgery at Baylor Scott & White Medical Center in Temple, Texas. I'm your host, Dr. Lonnie Gentry. The Stats podcast is sponsored by Dr. Harry Papaconstantino, the chair of the Department of Surgery. This is a unique episode for the Stats podcast in that we are talking not to a surgeon, but to someone who provides support for surgeons and other medical professionals. This support is provided when they face what are called healthcare adversities, which we will define shortly. The person that we have the privilege of speaking with today is Maxine Trent, the Baylor Scott & White Health System Director of Staff Support. Maxine is a licensed professional counselor and a licensed marriage and family therapist. In her work at Baylor Scott & White, she oversees the Peer Support Program, which boasts 510 volunteers across the system. Maxine, thanks for joining me today.
Thank you. It's quite an honor to be here today. I can't tell you how grateful I am for the opportunity to serve here at Baylor Scott & White Health.
Well, it's my privilege to be here to help you share that today. I recently read the inspiring story about how you came to your current position here at Baylor Scott & White. Can you tell us that story as we get started?
Well, I'd be delighted to. I'd like to rewind a bit before that story that was told through the BSW Connect page. So I've been a therapist for over 3 decades. I really consider myself a trauma specialist, a trauma therapist, because of my training with Department of Defense. I was providing therapy for pilots at Naval Air Station Corpus Christi. And this innovative trauma intervention called Eye Movement Desensitization Reprocessing, EMDR, became available. And the Navy wanted specialists trained in it so that we could utilize trauma intervention with pilots without decompartmentalizing them. After all, they're flying million-dollar airplanes, and we don't want them to forget their procedural memory and or have mistakes while flying. But we also needed them to be able to heal when unfortunate, unanticipated events happened, like they lost a team member out at sea. So I was trained in EMDR and found it to be very helpful. In fact, interventional in bringing light to the heart of darkness in trauma. So that training transpired back in the 1990s. And when my husband and I moved back from Yokosuka, Japan, where we were stationed, to Texas, I was able to then become a consultant and to advance in the training with EMDR. I started with Baylor Scott & White Health in 2001, and days later, actually September 1st, 2001, and 10 days later, the whole world changed.
Oh, that's right.
Yeah. And so I was providing child and adolescent psychotherapy through the child and adolescent department in psychiatry. Really enjoying the interdisciplinary, collegiate atmosphere there. Just love working with the psychiatrist and the psychologist and doing the work. But after 9/11, was concerned that I had all this training and all this experience working with forward deployed service members, and was seeing kids and families, but it was good work. And I felt like I was where I needed to be and that I was doing what I was supposed to be doing. But in 2007, a grant came across the Department of Psychiatry. And actually, our department chair walked into a staff meeting and said, "Is there anybody in here who wants to work with military?" There were two of us that raised our hands that day, and the result of that became the Scott & White Military Homefront Services. And we served thousands and thousands of team members, thousands and thousands of military members and their families. It was individual marital family therapy. We did combat stress. And as a result of our close working relationship with Fort Hood, after the first massacre on Fort Hood, the November 5th, 2009, massacre on Fort Hood, we were asked to provide services to the DOD civilians because they didn't have a mechanism to treat their trauma. And so my team of 13 and I did that. And it was through that experience that I truly felt called to help helpers. I had never really contemplated how the training and the working in healthcare could be acutely stressful and at times traumatic until having that opportunity. And my heart just felt pulled. I felt called to help helpers. And shortly thereafter, I mean, just a few years later, I was made aware of an opportunity through a grant that Lisa Havens had written to come to risk management legal of all places from psychiatry and to help begin a program to help helpers, a second victim program. And we can talk about all that verbiage here in a minute. But at the time, Bob Pryor, our pediatric intensivist, was naming everything, and he named it SWADL.
I remember that.
Because of the SWA. And we found words to put with that, staff well-being assistance during difficult life events. And it was that until just before COVID hit, when the executive team decided to change the name to reflect what we actually do, which is peer support. And so since 2018, 19, the name of the program's been Peer Support. I have to confess, SWADL program was phenomenal, but selling the name.
I actually remember discussions about the name. It wasn't the strongest point.
It was a little painful.
Yeah.
Particularly when briefing orthopedic surgeons and such, that was a little painful. But the program itself was robust and still is, and is a delight to be a part of.
What is healthcare adversity?
So glad you asked. Healthcare adversity is the underbelly of providing care. It's the things we hope never happen. It's the adverse events, the medical errors, subsequent claims, litigation, board complaint. In 2014, we did a qualitative study to really try to ensure that the program would cover all of the bases, would do all that we needed it to do at Baylor Scott & White Health. We knew that when team members had adverse events, it was negatively impacting. We knew that medical errors were very impactful. We also knew that the long haul of claim, litigation, and board complaint had a negative effect, particularly on providers, particularly on our team members that were providing care. What we learned is the very nature of the legal world is detrimental in that the first thing you will be told is don't talk to anybody. Don't talk to anybody about this. We don't want anything said about this except for to your legal representative. And what we learned is that people desperately need to process. They need to be able to talk about the experience that they've had in order to integrate the experience and cope with it. That people needed a safe place where it could be talked about. We learned that claim and litigation at the end of the day feels like a never-ending marathon with the length of it, and that really the legal world operates the opposite of what the medical field does. It's a game of hurry up and wait. Whereas in medicine, we make diagnosis, we come up with a treatment plan, and we rigorously pursue treatment. So what we learned was that it was difficult, sometimes incredibly difficult, for healthcare team members to bear the burden, and that we had to create a safe place, a safe way for people to process the emotions, the experience that they were having with claim, litigation, board complaint, but more importantly, with adverse event and with error. Mm. I had a team member during those focus groups basically tell me that board complaint makes you question your call to medicine, that it was devastating.
Wow.
It was personal, and it defied your professional defense mechanisms. The Texas Medical Board absolutely has to investigate each and every complaint, no matter how erroneous it is. Hmm. So you are guilty until you are proven innocent. And you are not supposed to talk about it.
That's a tough obligation.
It's devastating. And more than one physician has walked away from their practice as a result of the experience. So Lisa Haven's vision of having a safe place and a safe cadre of professionals to come alongside, to provide mentorship and or support during those adversities, was the reason that we started peer support. We learned so much through that qualitative study about what we shouldn't do. We shouldn't assume, and we should meet people where they are. We should have like minds, like training, same gender, peers to provide support. Because you don't want to talk to somebody who's never been trained in your discipline about an adverse event or an error. You want to talk to somebody who's actually been in your shoes, who knows what it's like to be on the cutting edge making those decisions. And it needs to be in a blame-free, shame-free environment.
What have you learned from directing the Better Scott & White Peer Support Second Victim Program? So I guess you'll need to define second victim there.
Yes, Dr. Wu in 2000 said that house staff, the original article was about house staff, that the first victim was the patient when there was a adverse event or a medical error. And the second victim was the providers that were involved in the care. It's continued to be used within the literature as the term that refers to the emotional downward spiral that we experience after a adverse event or medical error. Baylor Scott & White Health, we really prefer the term clinician impact, although that's not established in the literature.
Okay.
The reason we prefer that term is because the reality is, no matter how safe our care systems become, there will still be anomalies. There will still be events. We can't completely, I know we're getting to zero preventable harm as quickly as we can, but there will still be things that happen that aren't supposed to happen. And it is natural and it is normal to have an emotional response to that. So the term second victim, which was intended to create a understanding of the impact, really sometimes creates a different level of experience for the provider because of the shame and because of the anger and frustration and the angst that you experience after something that's not supposed to happen happens. It's incredibly devastating. It's very impactful.
The word second victim is a powerful way. It evokes that impact on someone's life.
Yes. But as a clinician, that impact continues, mm-hmm. particularly for surgeons.
Tell us about the surgeon's experience of Second Victim.
Well, it's in the literature and has been duly noted by Brigham Women's and a number of other Boston and number of other groups that surgeons indeed experience Second Victim or clinician impact, whichever term you prefer. Mm-hmm. And that in those moments when you recognize there has been an adverse event or a error, you do all that you can. Your procedural memory comes to the forefront, and you do all that you can to stabilize, to correct, to create safety. And you will naturally, with your team, remediate whatever the event was. It's in the aftermath. It's in the outside the OR when your brain begins to hiccup on the event. Whether it was pre-operative or post-operative, your brain tends to go over and over and over and over and questions. Question every decision, every movement, every moment. And I have seen it repeatedly in my privileged work as a supporter in this arena. Your brain hiccups on the event, and it takes up an incredible amount of mental real estate. And a lot of times you will have the opportunity to review the care that was provided with your leadership, sometimes with peer review, sometimes with colleagues and mentors who are incredibly supportive and helpful in terms of the experience, but ultimately what you're experiencing is acute stress. And in those moments, you may question whether this is what you want to do because it's intense and it's painful.
It's hard to imagine someone who has trained so long in their life and given so much to walk away. But you said earlier, sometimes that happens.
Mm-hmm. Sadly. The grief, the pain. I had a pediatric surgeon say to me during our original study, "Maxine, no matter what, Second Victim program or peer support says, you can't change the fact that I know if I had made other decisions, children that are not alive today would have lived."
That's powerful.
It changed me. The past 10 years, I have been pursuing how can we help? What can we do? Perhaps that's my story. That's my nature. Perhaps it's because as an EMDR therapist, I kind of relate to particularly surgeons. I really want to know how we can help. We know psychological first aid and active listening in those fresh moments after an event can provide stabilization and safety. I know surgeons' procedural memories are going to carry them through. I know that there are already coping mechanisms that are in place that each individual has in order to survive. My concern is your ability to thrive. My desire is to bring spaces that are safe for you and however you pursue healing and help to occur.
So obviously you can't do it yourself.
Absolutely not.
So you have this program of peer support. So who do you recruit to, I guess, train?
The program accepts nominations for volunteers. We're looking for folks who have had experiences and are feeling that they have worked through them and would like to help others who've had the experiences, whether that be an unanticipated event, an adverse event, an error, a claim, a litigation, a board complaint. We're looking for folks who are seasoned in healthcare and want to support their colleagues you don't have to be a gifted therapeutic person. Dr. John Eight, who's a proponent for second victim programs and vascular surgeon, has told me, Maxine, we don't want to de-glove our surgeons. And he's right. He's absolutely right. We don't. What we want is to create safety, meaning use that little committee protection that the program has through the peer review oversight committee approval to protect people who are willing and able to step into those spaces that are sacred after an oopsie or oh my God has happened, and to support their colleague as their colleague makes sense and processes the experience and finds where it's going to land within their soul garden, because it's different for everybody. But what we want to do is help when working in healthcare hurts.
Those conversations are confidential.
Completely. We do not keep records. And as I said, our volunteers are protected under the Peer Review Oversight Committee. Gratefully, we have not been tested, but we are also not documenting, and we are not creating a space that would lend itself to being called, subpoenaed, or a part of litigation. One of the things that happens with the litigation team, claims and litigation team, is the first notification, you'll get an inside attorney, you'll get a paralegal, you'll have either Connie Moore or myself available there for you to do acutely stressful interventions like recent traumatic episode protocol or to try to help you in those moments. And then the next thing we ask is, would you like a healthcare adversity mentor? Would you like someone who has been through this before to come alongside and to support you? What we found frequently, folks want a volunteer that they're not in meetings with. It's the blessing of having such a big system. Mm. Folks want a colleague that, you know, they won't have to bump into meetings so that they can keep it compartmentalized, which is wise. But that those connections can be life-sustaining. They can make all the difference in the world, particularly with litigation, which can last years. I mean, the legal world is the opposite of healthcare. It's hurry up and wait. And it's maddening. It's absolutely maddening for those of us who are accustomed to a high-paced tempo. Mm-hmm.
What else would you want us to know?
Well, I need help finding out what best practices are for helping helpers when unanticipated things happen, particularly surgeons. The ability to come alongside and to support in such a critical space is afforded through the care teams that we provide and the OR teams that are available here at Baylor Scott & White. But what we don't have is best practices. We don't know in the literature what helps in those moments. We think we know, but we've never had any study.
Oh, wow.
We don't have any qualitative data that says, okay, these folks say these themes of support and help, these words, these actions are useful when there is an unanticipated event. And so I would very much like to find out and have a study that I'd like to submit to the IRB that's qualitative, phenomenological. I would like to ask the question, and I'm going to need at least 20 people to give me 15 to 30 minutes to answer. Has there ever been a time where you had something happen and someone came alongside and by their words or their actions helped you feel better in the difficult circumstance? Was there anything along the lines that you found useful and helpful?
So there's not literature on that?
There's really not. We do not have best practices. We know that shame is a big part, and we know that Dr. Bynum and the SHAME lab at Duke is working on SHAME competence. But we don't have within surgery, the culture of surgery, best practices.
For helping
each other.
You know how they feel, but you need data on how to help them feel better.
How to support in those moments. Because it's sacred ground.
Could be groundbreaking.
My prayer is that it would help somebody.
I'm sure. So they could contact you, people that hear this podcast and have an interest.
If you'd like to be a part of that study, please. Maxine.Trent@bswhealth.org.
Right. That sounds great. I wish you the best on that.
I appreciate that, Lonnie.
Yeah, this has been a delightful conversation. I appreciate so much what you're doing for our medical staff that faces these hard times. And I know that it's making a difference.
You know, with the statistic recently out that a surgeon is 289% more likely to be involved in litigation than the average American.
Is that right?
289% more likely to find themselves in the legal world than the average American. I hope we have programs like peer support across the nation.
I do too. May your tribe increase.
Thank you, sir.
That concludes this episode of Stats. Be on the lookout for the next episode of Sharing the Accomplishments of Temple Surgery.